It debunks the belief that Jesus walked on water. It debunks the idea that Jesus turned water into wine. It debunks the idea that Judas betrayed Jesus for money and that Judas committed suicide.
It's Matt Lauer of the Today Show commenting on some of the things he found in this new book, co-authored by a best-selling author and a Roman Catholic Bible scholar, called The Gospel According to Judas. It is different from the Judas Gospel. It's a modern work of fiction, but the authors want it to be taken seriously as another point of view, plausible, probable point of view, among the other things that it debunks there. It keeps a lot of things intact, but the scholarly approach has been to look at the New Testament Gospels and say, well, we know what they say, but what we're really concerned is about what they're trying to say or what they meant to say. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's audio open lines for the next hour. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before we go on to another Today Show segment on the Jesus Tomb documentary, a debate between, I think it's the director of the film and Bill Donahue from the Catholic League. It's the Catholic League. Before we go into that, I want to clarify something I said on before the break, just so no one misunderstands. A thing that claims to be true but not factual is a myth. That's what you call it. It claims to communicate. It's true in the sense of what it's trying to communicate, but it makes no claims as to being factually or historically true. What would be a good example of a myth that teaches what it teaches is true, but it does not claim to be making any historical, planting any flags historically? Any of Aesop's fables, for that matter, the parables of Jesus, do not claim to be, at least as far as we know. Some of them may actually be stories of real events, but we don't know that for sure. But the parables of Jesus, by and large, are understood to be in that category of things that are true, but not factual. In other words, Jesus isn't claiming that there ever really was a man who had two sons and one of them asked for the inheritance. He's teaching about something other than a man. He's teaching about God. So when Jesus tells that parable, what he says is altogether true, but he's making no historical claims. You could call it a parable or myth or an extended allegory, whatever you want to call it. And I said before the break, there's nothing wrong with the myth, as long as the myth is upfront about what it is. Jesus, when he tells the parable of the prodigal son, or whatever you want to call it, when he tells that parable, he's completely upfront about what he's trying to do. I'm telling you something by telling you a story, a fictional story. The problem comes when something claims to be historically true, but it turns out to be a myth, or something is portrayed as a myth, but it turns out to be historically true. And this is the problem with this modern biblical scholarship. It looks at documents, namely the New Testament Gospels, which there is no way you can read these in an honest way and come to the conclusion that they purport to be something other than historical claims. There's no signal in the text. There's no preface by the author. There's no, let me tell you a story, or once upon a time. There's none of that to the New Testament Gospels. On the face of it, they present themselves as historical documents, fully founded in fact. And what do modern biblical scholars do with them? They say, well, we know what they say, but maybe it's more important that we determine what they meant to say, or what they're trying to say, or what they mean to say. They treat historical documents as though they were myths. And the irony of it all is that this is in a day and age when the Da Vinci Code, which is blatantly, obviously, a myth, not even really a myth, just a fiction, is treated and honored as though it might even be history. It's amazing. No myths and no parables in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March called Easter is for me. Know the events of Jesus' life and death and resurrection for us sinners are facts, and they're true. They're not there to teach us a lesson, but to communicate what Jesus actually accomplished in time in history through his life, death, and resurrection for us sinners. It's beautifully communicated in this book, Easter is for me. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. You can find out more at our website, issuesetc.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Steve writes this from St. Louis. Since we have the ancient Gospel of Judas, and now the new Gospel according to Judas, what's next? A musical? Wait, Andrew Lloyd Webber already has done that with Jesus Christ Superstar. Thank you very much, Steve. Nice sense of humor. Well, it's only a matter of time. Andrew Lloyd Webber has a knack for taking interesting stories, interesting books, interesting movies, and putting them on Broadway. I wouldn't be surprised. I wonder if you'll see the scene. It's hard to make a musical about Judas because the real big money scene is 30 pieces of silver. Maybe for that reason, since it's not in the Gospel according to Judas, this new bestseller, maybe Andrew Lloyd Webber will take a pass on this one. Who knows, Steve? Thank you. Well, in a similar vein, and with as little genuine biblical scholarship to back it up, the Jesus tomb debate continues. Here's a piece from a recent Today show.
This morning on Today's Update, the controversy over that documentary and book called The So-Called Lost Tomb of Jesus. We first met the people behind the Jesus Family Tomb Project last month. They said they'd uncovered the archaeological find of all time. But the debate isn't over by a long shot. Simca, you believe you have found the family tomb of Jesus.
We're looking at the bone box inscribed Jesus, son of Joseph.
I haven't seen anything that contradicts the initial hypothesis.
It was a blockbuster claim made here on the Today Show and in the Discovery documentary, The Lost Tomb of Jesus.
I'm not a theologian. We're here, we're reporters, and we're reporting the facts.
Journalist Simca Yankubovich and filmmaker James Cameron arguing this ossuary held the remains of Jesus, that this was the final resting place of Mary Magdalene, and most shocking of all, that this might be the ossuary of their son named Judah. If this is correct, what are the implications? They're huge.
They are huge, all of this.
But almost immediately, other scholars began to refute the findings.
It does not read Mariamne. It's the name of two people, not just one. Two different scripts by two different scribes.
And much like the fictional Da Vinci Code, critics argued this was an attempt to undermine religious belief.
I think the lost tomb of Jesus was a lot of lost time.
It was 2,000 years old.
They tried to make a cinematic mountain out of this evidentiary molehill.
Our own viewers weighed in, arguing their faith was being unfairly attacked. I feel this is a sensational story that is designed to make much money for these two gentlemen. And it doesn't make sense. Still, the Discovery Project was a hit, attracting 8 million viewers, and the associated book is currently sixth on the New York Times bestseller list. Leaving the academic community to debate its accuracy, while others continue to ask, is Christianity under assault?
There is a feeling on the part of many religious believers, particularly Christians, that it's open season.
The pattern is not attacking Christianity, it's capitalizing on Christianity. There's a tremendous thirst of interest.
Charles Pellegrino is co-author of The Lost Tomb of Jesus, and Bill Donahue is president of the Catholic League. Good morning, gentlemen, to both
of
you.
Good morning.
Bill, if I could start with you. You believe that this book and the documentary have an anti-Christian agenda. Why do you believe that?
Before we get Bill Donahue's response there, and we refer to Bill Donahue around here at Issues, etc., as the Catholic Jerry Falwell. There's a lot of heat, or what it was, heat but no light, or light but no heat. Which is it? A lot of wind, a lot of commotion, sometimes not a lot of substance. But I'm interested to hear what he has to say. What interested me from the package they played there for the Today Show is that, did you know that, Jeff, you're the broadcasting guy. Is 8 million viewers for this documentary, even on cable television, is 8 million viewers to be considered a hit? I mean, would you consider that a hit? If you had 8 million viewers for this documentary.
For a Sunday night cable television.
Right. Okay. My understanding is that the highest rated program on the Discovery Channel is a little program I love to watch it at every opportunity called Mythbusters. You ever seen this thing? Oh, come on. You're missing out on the best television there ever was. Really. But I would love to see the Mythbusters take on the Jesus tomb. They won't do it. I mean, they don't do that kind of thing, but it's as big a myth as anything else. I can't believe you don't watch the Mythbusters. Do you go to bed really early, or is that what it is?
Yeah, I've got a 4-month-old, so we sleep whenever we can.
Oh, I forgot. That's right. You got one of those little ones at home. I had forgotten that. Maybe I shouldn't be working him so hard. I kind of feel guilty now, actually. You forget that they have a baby at home and they're changing diapers in the middle of the night. It might account for the slack in his work lately. Maybe that's what it is. Well, the Mythbusters basically take an urban legend, a myth, whatever it may be, and they test it to see if it's confirmed or plausible or, in their terms, busted. It didn't take the Mythbusters to put together a fairly resounding busted judgment on the Jesus tomb. I don't know why people are still debating it. People talk about how this is an attack on the Christian faith. It most certainly is an attempted attack on the Christian faith. And I think we do need to admit that if it could be, that it could be demonstrated in some way that Jesus was still dead in the tomb, as Paul says, then our faith is in vain. Of course, Paul is able to make that bold, throw down the gauntlet, make that bold challenge to anyone, because he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that Christ was no longer in the tomb. He'd seen him alive. It was actually just kind of a matter of putting two and two together. He can't still be dead in the tomb if he's appearing to me alive in the body. But I don't see why any Christians had any. I can understand why you'd be annoyed, outraged, disturbed, perhaps even a little worried that, yes, the popular culture and the broadcasting industry has finally decided to take on even the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But really, truly challenged in your faith, I don't see it. Not only because of the poor scholarship of it, but also because we have the truth, and that means the facts and the history on our side. And we really have nothing to worry about. But it would be kind of interesting to see the Mythbusters take this on. Unfortunately, the caliber of debate here is hardly something you want to ride home about. But nonetheless, we'll see what Bill Donahue has to say. The question put to him is, he views the Jesus Tomb documentary as an attack on the Christian faith and beliefs.
And well, because every Lent we go through this, don't we? Since 1990, we've tracked it to the Catholic League. Somebody comes out with some idea about Jesus not being real. He wasn't divine. He was just a carpenter. There was no resurrection. But you know what? I look at this book. There's not one citation in the book. There's not one footnote. There's not one endnote. Both of us have doctorates. We know the way science proceeds. You go through a peer review, or you presented your findings in a scientific journal. James Cameron was right. He said it reads like a detective novel because it is a novel.
We had to protect the tomb for a start, and if we had to keep the word from getting out there, the tomb from being damaged, and as far as the peer review, I mean, go back to Pellegrino versus Poynar, a guy who was stealing papers that he rejected, publishing under his name, and the system protected him for 15 years until it got too extreme. It's not an attack on Christianity at all. In fact, looking into the details, and there are scientific papers coming out, releasable at the time that the tomb could be released.
The archaeologists have not been rushing to your side to defend you
in
the last few weeks.
Well, Stephen, his claim fell apart within about 3 hours.
Charles, let
he
me
was
ask re- you about...
To come up with the idea that it was two names, he had to drop clear Greek punctuation on the ossuary. It was like taking the name Pellegrino and dropping a few letters to turn
Mary
it into
Magdalene?
Pellegro, yes, the Mary Magdalene. It was like saying Pellegrino really means danger instead of pilgrim by just dropping a few letters. That's exactly what he did.
Okay, as I said, the quality of the debate here is less than optimal. they're throwing back a, they're, how anyone can figure out what they're talking about, I don't know. But at least, here's the problem. If you're going to go to a knife fight like this, at least bring your sharpest knife, right? So Bill Donahue, I do have a lot of respect for Bill Donahue, especially his passion for certain subjects. If you're going to go to a knife fight like this, bring your sharpest knife. Your sharpest knife isn't, there are no footnotes in this book. That's not your best point. How about this? This would just be good. Why, among all of the ancient things you looked at, like ossuaries and ancient DNA, why didn't you also look at the ancient documents pertaining to Jesus and take them as seriously as you claim to have taken the ossuaries and the DNA? Why did you exclude the greatest body of evidence, and it is evidence, not for the promises, but for the history and the facts. Why did you exclude the greatest body of evidence we have pertaining to Jesus Christ? That's the question you ask the Jesus Tomb people. Why are you willing to take an ossuary seriously and DNA evidence seriously, but not ancient documents that are contemporaneous with the events? Why not? That's what you do. There's your sharpest knife. Make the advocates of the Jesus Tomb theory explain why they disregard the New Testament. They might have some good arguments for disregarding the New Testament. Who knows? But the subject doesn't even get raised. It's, you didn't have any footnotes in your book. Look, I've written a lot of things, some of them heavily footnoted, and some of them with no footnotes whatsoever. I do not want someone judging the truth of what I write based upon the number of letters or numbers at the end of the document. All right, let's go back to the Today Show encounter between this advocate for the Jesus Tomb and Bill Donahue of the Catholic League.
You have said that
it had to be retracted.
You've said that in this research, and you're agnostic, that you actually found some basis for faith in doing this.
Yeah, there are numerous congruences with exactly what ancient early Christian scripture and texts say we should find. The Jesus ossuary, there's been a lot of talk about bones supposedly being in the ossuary. And I'm the guy who's been going through it millimeter by millimeter. Bones have turned out to be mostly crystal structure, bioconcretions around fibers. Interestingly, some of the plainest fibers. At this point, the evidence is pointing toward a shroud would have been what was buried in the
and
Jesus ossuary.
And what's the significance
ossuary.
Of that? No bones.
Something happened. Either someone stole away with the bones or the body in antiquity, or something else happened.
As in a resurrection.
The material that's consistent with shroud, possibly, but the I don't know. That's an area where I don't
You're
know,
doing
and
more
that's
study.
What agnostic
right.
means, lacking knowledge.
Let me ask
but
Bill.
It's,
Bill,
it's absolutely fascinating what we're finding millimeter by millimeter,
okay, Bill,
and it is consistent.
Let me give Bill a chance to get in here. What is your real concern about this, your fear about books like this and documentaries?
Well, you know, we went through this with the Da Vinci Code, and we found out the guy came up with the idea of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. That guy spent time in prison because he was a fraud, that whole idea of the Priory of Sion. Now the guy with the James ossuary, this guy's on trial in Israel right now. The cops have found that this guy has been selling millions of dollars worth of his stuff to people and to museums. They found the forgery documents. You guys are still the only ones left who believe that this guy is not a fraud. That's where your credibility just implodes.
Were an attempt to divorce the James ossuary from this tomb.
The test on the DNA was
an attempt. If they matched maternally, that was a test of doubt. If these two ossuaries matched maternally, it would have meant, well, then this is not consistent with Scripture.
Gentlemen, we've got to end it right there. I apologize.
Where did Judah come from?
Guys, you
Jesus'
can keep
son, where did he come
said
from?
That if there was a child, the name he would expect to be inscribed would have been Didymos Judas
I thought
Thomas.
It would be O'Malley.
Gentlemen, you can continue to debate this. We're going to debate it forever
Don't
and ever.
Don't make an ossuary of yourself.
That's really
on that
good.
Note,
That's
on
really
that
good.
Conspiratory note, we'll be back
we'll
right after
later.
This. Bill and Charles, thanks very much.
Well, it does tell you something about how seriously you should take something like the Jesus Tomb documentary when, what, a couple weeks after it aired, this the Today Show is the big time. I think it's safe to say that NBC in the morning during a weekday is the big time. When they can't scrape up something better than this by way of a debate, probably wasn't worth too much consideration in the first place. At least serious consideration. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't react to it, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have answers for this. To simply say, well, I'm not going to give an answer because it's too ridiculous, is a cop-out. Even ridiculous claims require answers. Do you care to react? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. You want my thoughts on this, Jeff? My final thoughts, hopefully my final thoughts on the Jesus tomb thing? You might be able to detect that I think that no matter how popular it was, there was too much time spent talking about it. Not because it deserves to be dismissed out of hand, but because almost from the moment the news was breaking about the Jesus tomb documentary, very few people were taking it seriously for good reason. I don't think I can do any better than what Paul says when he's writing to the Corinthians. If he hasn't been raised, then our faith is hollow, empty, and meaningless. And in fact, we are of all men most to be pitied because we have been proven to be liars. Paul says, if Christ isn't raised, then I speak as Paul. If Christ isn't raised, I am a liar. This isn't just Paul having a fit of pride and saying, I'm so confident in my position, I challenge anyone to bring evidence that Jesus is still dead in the tomb. No, he is driving straight at the heart of what the Christian faith is, and that event upon which all the promises of God, Old Testament, New Testament, ultimately hang. They ultimately hang entirely upon whether or not Jesus is dead in the tomb or alive and ascended to the Father on the right hand of God. And if he is not alive, then nothing that Paul teaches or that you hear on this radio program is really worth listening to. It is a huge waste of time. There's that old song that the Gaithers made popular, I think. He lives, he lives. Remember that one? And then it comes to the chorus and the crescendo. You ask me how I know he lives. He lives within my heart. That's not how Christians know he lives. We know he lives because those who saw him, touched him, handled him, have proclaimed to us what they saw and touched and handled. They proclaimed it through the words of the New Testament. Really, what Mary and the other women did after they witnessed Jesus raised from the dead on Easter morning is no different than what Peter then did when he proclaimed Christ raised from the dead, or Paul did later, or after the time of the apostles, preacher after preacher after preacher, generation after generation did too. They proclaimed Christ crucified and risen from the dead for the forgiveness of all our sins. We'll be right back.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, senior editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
The Age of the Earth, What does science say?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the best-selling book, The Lie Evolution. Ken, is there any scientific evidence to prove the Earth is young?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that scientists can't prove that the Earth is old or young. You see, all the dating methods used by scientists are based on some big assumptions, and the only way scientists can prove the Earth's age is if they know someone who was there at the beginning to record the facts. But scientists, of course, don't have any such human eyewitnesses. They can only make assumptions based on what we see today. You know, God must look down on such human efforts as people try to understand things without seeking Him for truth. And that's why God asked Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" In other words, he asked, "Were you there?" You know, while no humans were there, God was. And He's given us a faultless record of those events. If we add up all the dates given in the Bible, we get a total of about 6,000 years of history, not billions of years. We can easily prove from the book of Genesis and God as an eyewitness that the earth is young, and nothing from science can contradict this.
Ken Ham's free booklet on the 6 days of creation shows that the Bible couldn't be more clear. God created everything in six literal 24-hour days. It's a fascinating booklet, and to find it, go to our website, AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief invites you to attend the LCMS Conference on Mercy, April 30th through May the 2nd at the St. Louis Airport Marriott. Keynote speakers include Pastor Harrison, Tim Gagline, Special Assistant to President Bush, and Dr. Leo Mackey, who most recently served as the Chief Operating Officer of one of the leading healthcare providers in the U.S. On Tuesday night, a special banquet with entertainment provided by Jazzmax recording artist Aaron Bodie. Meet Issues Etc. regular guests Arthur Just, Beverly Yonke, Larry Rast, Gene Edward Veith, Uwe Simonetto, and more. Plus, we'll be there broadcasting live. Now, for more information, just look for the LCMS Conference on Mercy logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. The LCMS Conference on Mercy, April the 30th through May the 2nd in St. Louis.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk to the hopefully recovered Gretchen Passantino. We tried to get her last week, and she was not feeling well. Hopefully she's recovered enough to talk to us tomorrow on the program about the 10th anniversary of the Heaven's Gate tragedy. Remember the Hale-Bopp comet? And remember the mass suicide that took place on the West Coast? We'll also talk about the Zoroastrian New Year. Did you know that Zoroastrians are monotheists? They believe in one God? It's true. Along with the respectable monotheists, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, we should include, if we're going to be mere monotheists, the Zoroastrians, too. And they're celebrating their new year. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us right here in the studio this Tuesday, the 27th of March, issues ETC at KFUO.org. Here's Steve calling from his car. Hi, Steve.
How you doing today?
Doing good.
Hey, question for you, and it's kind of a rhetorical question. Okay, let's assume for a moment that those were Jesus' bones. For a lot of Christians, or so-called Christians, would that change the way they view things, or would they still view Christianity as a moral structure?
Well, you raise an excellent question, and I think it's one that we really should have been talking more about during the whole Jesus tomb, Jesus ossuary debate, and that is, I suspect that there are Christians who would say it doesn't make any difference at all. Even if Jesus' dead body had been found in the tomb Easter morning and had been a place of pilgrimage and we could still go and visit it and see the mummified body of Jesus. I think there are Christians who would say it wouldn't make any difference because, after all, he was such a great teacher. such a good moral teacher, left us with so many good principles for living, taught us how to live, if not the Christian life, let's not call it the Christian life, we could still wear our What Would Jesus Do bracelets, couldn't we? Because we'd still have all that good stuff that he did and taught, and wasn't he so loving and sweet? But Paul has absolutely no patience for that kind of thinking. He says, if he isn't raised, then it's not worth listening to him. He's not that remarkable of a moral teacher if he isn't raised. And he doesn't say, now if Christ is not raised, then, well, while our faith is in vain, he still left us one whiz-bang of a moral system to live by, and we could still ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? No, he just says, we are of all men most to be pitied. We are still in our sin, because after all, that's what Jesus came for, to deal with our sin in his sacrifice at the cross. And we're doomed if Christ is not raised.
I don't think we'd have Christians that say it doesn't make a difference, but functionally and practically, the Jesus they're getting week in and week out at their church?
No, you would have quote-unquote people who call themselves Christians who said it wouldn't make any difference.
Call themselves Christians.
And I'm thinking here about probably more often than not in the left wing of the church.
Yeah, like John Dominic Crossan said that on our show.
Right,
we don't need the resurrection.
It doesn't make any difference. Right. Jesus, we can still participate in the Christ life or something, whatever nonsense he was babbling on about. That's where I earn my money in those interviews, where I have to sit and listen to that stuff. But you're right. In practical terms, the Jesus that many Christians who do affirm the resurrection, in theory, who do affirm the resurrection, in practical terms, the Jesus that they're getting on Sunday morning from their pulpits doesn't have to have died and doesn't have to have risen again. That's just not really central to the kind of Jesus they're getting. It doesn't really make any difference in practical terms, because what they're getting, the Jesus they're getting on Sunday morning from their pulpits, is the moral lawgiver, principles for living, what would Jesus do, Jesus. That's why What Would Jesus Do was so funny. Because it was a question speculating what Jesus would do I wouldn't have had a big problem with what would Jesus do if it would have been what did Jesus do. Because that we can answer. That's a question we can answer. But what would Jesus do is a question that no one can answer, except Jesus himself. Warren Jeffs made the news even before his arrest as the leader of what was considered at the time a pretty dangerous group of Mormons practicing polygamy. It's called the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints. Do you remember when he was arrested? It was just a routine traffic stop that brought in Warren Jeffs, and now he's facing a number of charges in several states. Here's an update from National Public Radio.
The polygamist Warren Jeffs is due back in a Utah courtroom today. He's got a hearing. The leader of the nation's largest polygamist group is charged with two counts of being an accomplice to rape. Mr. Jeff's attorneys will argue that their client is so notorious and his polygamous religion so reviled that his trial should be moved to the opposite end of the state. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from St. George, Utah.
Rod Parker doesn't think polygamy prophet Warren Jeffs can get a fair trial in his home county on the Utah-Arizona border.
I think it is a poisoned atmosphere.
Parker bases that on his own experience. He represented Jeffs in civil cases and one of Jeff's followers against charges of polygamy and unlawful sex with a minor.
The case had a lot of publicity about child brides and claims of forced marriage and those sorts of things. People had really latched onto that. They had very deep opinions about that when we encountered them in the jury selection process.
The Warren Jeffs case has had similar widespread publicity, along with an endless stream of stories about the 6,000 or so members of the polygamous church Jeffs leads. He bears the burden of their reputation as well as his own. The Jeffs defense team says that's clear in a poll they commissioned. 200 people were interviewed in the group's home region of Washington County. 200 more were surveyed in Salt Lake County, the Utah metropolis a six-hour drive north. Now, neither the defense team nor their pollster nor the prosecution would speak for this story. So we turn to political pollster Anna Greenberg for analysis.
When I look at the numbers in the survey, I see that there's no doubt that
people who live in Washington County have stronger feelings about the presumption of guilt. You have, you know, about half or a little over half who say that the defendant is definitely guilty. When you look at Salt Lake County, you see that that number is smaller.
But the poll also asked whether Jeffs was probably guilty. The share of those surveyed who said Jeffs was either probably or definitely guilty is almost identical in both Washington and Salt Lake counties. About 75% of the people surveyed in both counties lean toward guilt.
The other thing that's striking to me is even though Salt Lake County is 6 hours away, almost everybody will offer an opinion about the case. Part of the argument when you ask for a change of venue is that you are locating a trial someplace where people are relatively unfamiliar with the details of the case. And what you see here is that most people already have an opinion about this case.
That doesn't surprise Eric Luna, a law professor at the University of Utah.
This case has been widely publicized in the United States and, in fact, around the globe. So I don't see that a change of venue motion moving the case to, from one county to the next is going to solve any concerns about impartiality and fairness.
Luna notes that all a trial needs is 12 jurors willing to be fair, not an entire county of them. Attorneys for polygamist Warren Jeffs hope a Utah judge will rule differently when they seek to move the Jeffs case in a pretrial hearing today. Howard Berkus, NPR News, St. George, Utah.
Okay, so this is all the political meandering. I think we could probably write the script from this point on, and that would be if they don't get their change of venue for Warren Jeffs, of course. Where could you send him in the country where people wouldn't have an opinion about a guy who led a fundamentalist Latter-day Saints church like a military compound, married pre... what am I trying to say here? Pre-teenagers, in some cases, off to middle-aged men in the dozens, has a couple dozen wives of his own, scores of children. People are going to have an opinion about that, no matter what you do. Of course, I think the ultimate legal goal here is probably to say he can't get a fair trial. No one will give him a fair trial. Or to ask for a mistrial after the trial's begun because it's so obviously unfair. Look, when what you have done is so obviously wrong that even in America, where practically nothing can be called immoral any longer, you must have really done something. It's Audio Open Lines, Issues, etc. About 15 minutes left in the program today. Happy to hear from you. Your questions, your comments, your reaction to the Warren Jeffs update, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. What if the religion that you practiced required animal sacrifice? Sounds like an Old Testament kind of ancient primitive kind of thing, doesn't it? Well, here's a story out of Texas from the AP about a church that has that problem.
I'm just a normal, regular human being that it just happened to believe in another different religion.
Jose Merced is a Santeria priest, a religion founded in Cuba in the 1500s. Now, in Euless, Texas, Santeria and its practices are at the center of a lawsuit.
In order to initiate a new member or a new priest, it is essential the sacrifice and the offering of a goat.
It's Merced's sacrifices that have brought police to his front door three times after neighbors notice animals like goats and chickens going into his home but not coming out.
I don't think it's anybody's business what's happening in my house when the doors and windows are closed. And if you know what's happening, it's because you're peeking through the fence or you're peeking through the window. And I don't do that to anybody. They don't do it to any other religions.
Merced says the city's law banning animal slaughter singles out his religion, although it's been in place since 1974. City officials won't comment on the case, but stand by the ordinance.
I don't think it would be my position to comment on what value it is to the community or from a practical standpoint. My position as director of the department is simply to enforce the language that's contained in here.
Merced stresses Santeria believers aren't devil worshippers, just that they choose to worship in a way that is different than most of the other people who live in Euless.
I think they think that every time they see three cars in front of the house, we're killing animals, and that's a wrong concept.
The city has offered to settle the lawsuit by occasionally allowing Merced to sacrifice chickens, as long as he limits the number of people at the ceremonies to 25. It's a deal he won't take.
I'm a believer. I'm a priest. I got people under me that I have initiated. And I'm not going to change my belief.
Without a clear compromise in sight, the case continues to make its way through the judicial system. Similar cases have gone all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Rich Matthews, The Associated Press, Euless, Texas.
It is a little amusing to consider the fact that here is a single Santeria priest in Euless, Texas, who refuses to capitulate to the cultural norms around him. He has more backbone than many Christian preachers do, who, with the slightest breeze of the cultural winds, fall over like they're made out of tissue paper. Should the Santeria priest be punished? Should he take the compromise? The city said, look, if you want to sacrifice a couple chickens every once in a while, as long as you don't put more than 25 people in the house while you're doing it, we'll let you do that. He says, no, it's got to be according to the dictates of Santeria, which is an odd, they didn't explain this too well. It's an odd mixture of Christian ideas. I think there's some kind of Caribbean voodoo stuck in there, and whatever Cuban indigenous religions there were in the 15th century. It's a weird thing. It's very popular in the Southwest and in Central and South America. And it does involve animal sacrifice. So what should law enforcement do about this? He says he's going to sacrifice his goats when he needs to. Issues ETC at KFUO.org is our email address. And our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think the government's overstepping its boundaries when it says, no, you can't sacrifice the goats, but you can sacrifice occasionally chickens with a small crowd? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issue ZTC at KFUO.org.
You're from that part of the country. You have no experience with this Santeria stuff?
No, I mean, it's a little bit of a backwater thing. I've never been a practitioner of Santeria.
You're a big hunter, though.
Sure, but that was not for religious purposes.
Oh, okay.
I don't hunt anymore, but I used to. And there was never any religious significance to it whatsoever.
Is this indicative of the religious landscape of Texas?
Yes. I'm being honest. Yes, it is. So what do you think they should do? Do you think the city officials, I mean, since obviously everyone's out mowing their grass right now and putting down fertilizer and trimming the bushes or whatever it is they're doing on a beautiful day like this, what do you think the city officials should do with the Santeria priest?
I just have a visual in my head of this guy debating Joel Osteen on NBC Today Show. Two Texas pastors.
What kind of a state must it be when you got Joel Osteen and the Santeria priest? What kind of a state must
only
it
in
be?
America?
It's a state of mind. It's a whole other country. That's their tourism boards, and nothing could be more true than that phrase. It is a whole other country. So, do you think law enforcement should say no animal sacrifice at all? He's got a religion that dates back to the 1500s. That's older than Mormonism. He's not asking to do anything that his religion, that any other practitioner of a religion isn't doing elsewhere. And he's just talking about sacrificing a goat. It's audio open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us issues, etc, at kfuo.org. Here's something I never expected to find out about. When you think of the words India and gay, you don't usually put them together. But apparently, in India, it is at the same time very easy and acceptable to be gay, and very difficult and unacceptable to be gay. How can this be? Let's hear the story from CNN.
Some questions that require a lot of thought and are increasingly important in this modern world. Earlier this month, we told you about...
That's the wrong audio. Let's get the right one, which would be... Jeff, you must have a different cut sheet than I do. Gay in India is track 12.
A group of gay Indian guys get together to celebrate the flamboyant Hindu festival of Holi.
Holi!
Okay, thank you.
here in New Delhi, the capital city, there's somewhere around 14 million people, but there really aren't very many spaces dedicated for gays and lesbians. So people, friends, just get together and hang out at places like this, here in the park.
Men roughhousing in public or even holding hands doesn't raise eyebrows in India. It's seen simply as a sign of companionship.
Indian society allows a lot of intimacy between people of the same sex that might be taboo in the West if you're not gay.
But being gay here.
But being gay is itself a huge problem, and there is a lot of homophobia in Indian society.
Mario Depenna is a 25-year-old gay man, one of the few we could find willing to talk on camera in a country where being gay can land you in jail. Part of Indian law, drafted in the 1860s when the country was still under British rule, reads, "Whoever voluntarily has carnal intercourse against the order of nature shall be punished with imprisonment and liable to fine."
It teaches society how to think about you. It legitimizes a view of gay people that is pejorative and negative.
Gautam Bahan wrote a book on queer politics in India. He says that being gay in India is completely different than it is in the West. One of the central issues here, the ubiquitous pressure to get married.
A lot of gay men use marriage to be free. A lot of gay men use marriage in order to be with their boyfriends. I mean, you can wear a tiara and a ball gown, you know, and walk down holding another man's hand. But if someone asks you and say, "Well, I don't know, I have a wife," you're done, you're clear, you can do whatever you want.
That's exactly the case for this man. He's married with three kids, but says he regularly sleeps with men. His wife doesn't know he's gay. The neighbors never stopped gossiping about me, he says. I got married only to prove to them that I was capable of producing babies and living a normal lifestyle. There are a few safe spaces for gays in India. The Naz Foundation is one such non-governmental organization. We're invited to join a weekly discussion. When I was in school, I tried to tell my teacher that I didn't know why I was getting attracted towards men, he says, but she beat me up and warned me to behave like a boy. Mario says the internet has opened new avenues to meet others, but the trying to do that in public can be dangerous.
We were together at nighttime, which was bad enough, and then the police nabbed us. The police took my money. I didn't ask for it. They just took my money.
Police say they take allegations of harassment seriously, and they're just doing their jobs, upholding the law.
Police over-jealous behavior, over-jealous conduct cannot be ruled out in some cases, but in most of the situations, these allegations are misplaced.
There are some portrayals of gays in India. A lesbian relationship was depicted in the movie Fire, released in India in 1998. But it drew protests from Hindu fundamentalist groups. Lesbian culture is not part of Indian culture, this political leader says.
What do you prefer?
But Mario thinks attitudes are changing. He works for a local NGO, but says as more Western companies open up shop in India, they bring with them their anti-discrimination laws.
Part of me wanting to work here is also because I can be out at work and I don't have to put up a pretense about my sexuality.
Many gays in India say a quiet battle is being waged here for acceptance of a lifestyle deemed by some as unnatural and carrying with it criminal punishment. Seth Doan, CNN, New Delhi.
Well, I guess the culture wars are everywhere. It would be interesting to know what Hinduism teaches about homosexuality, or whether it's just a cultural taboo in India, apart from any kind of religious concerns. It's fair to say that in the United States, the concerns here have their genesis in religious concerns, Christian religious concerns. Of course, you don't have to be a Christian to be concerned about the issue of homosexuality. I want to come back in the last few minutes here of the program to the issue of the scholarship we were talking about before. Think about it merely in terms of basic human communication. applying the standard to sound biblical scholarship that we apply each and every day in our own lives as we communicate with one another. I mean, think about the New Testament in that way. Although the New Testament is ancient, although its origins are distant from us in time and space, although the world in which the New Testament was written was a long time ago and very far, far away, it is in many ways little different than someone telling you what they saw happen on the street today. When I get home, my wife is going to tell me about what happened during the day for her. If I want marital bliss, and if I want a peaceful evening in the Wilkin house, I will listen carefully to exactly what she says. And I will receive her communication as plain, ordinary, spoken language. She's not trying to pull any tricks, not telling me any parables, not trying to portray any myths. She wouldn't, if I said, honey, how was your day, say, well, let me tell you a little story. And launch into a big thing about flying tigers and kings and queens. She doesn't. She just tells me this plain, simple facts of her day. That's what the New Testament is doing. If Bible scholars would realize only this, that the New Testament is attempting, in the simplest, plainest, and yet most accurate way, read the prologue of the Gospel of Luke, to simply tell us what these men saw, heard, or as one of the apostles says, what we saw with our eyes, what we handled with our hands, this we make known to you concerning the word of life. And they're not talking about some mythical word of life. They're talking about Christ himself, crucified and risen for us. If scholars would realize only that, we'd have better scholarship. Join us for the LCMS Conference on Mercy. It's April the 30th through May the 2nd at the St. Louis Airport Marriott. We're going to be broadcasting live there. They got great speakers. They got a banquet with entertainment provided by Jazzmax recording artist Aaron Bodie. And for more information on the LCMS Conference on Mercy, look for the logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. As I said, we'll be broadcasting live from the LCMS Conference on Mercy, April the 30th through May the 2nd at the Airport Marriott here in St. Louis. Tomorrow on the program, it's been 10 years since there was a mass suicide on the West Coast. It was the Heaven's Gate cult. They thought that they were aliens put here on Earth and that they were going to return to the Hale-Bopp comet. We'll find out what the life in the cults are 10 years after that. We'll also talk with Gretchen Passantino about the Zoroastrian New Year. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.